Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Going to tell you some stories about Yunyan and Dawu to begin with. Probably you've heard all these stories before. These are the stories we tell all the time in our practice. Lots of famous stories about Yunyan and Dawu, who were Dharma brothers in classical Chinese Zen times. And they studied together and traveled together. Dawu was the elder of the two, and seemed to be often a little short with and sometimes scornful of his possibly naive younger brother, Yunyan. So I'm going to tell two stories about Yunyan and Dawu. In one story, Yunyan is sweeping the ground outside the temple, and Dawu observes him sweeping and says to him, "Too busy." And Yunyan replies, "You should know that there's one who's not busy." Dawu says, "Oh, then there are two moons?" And Yunyan holds up the broom. He says, "Which moon is this?" So some years ago, when smartphones were just starting to be ubiquitous, and everybody, maybe you remember this, everybody was complaining about how busy they were and how multitasking was driving them crazy. So I wrote about this story that I just told you as the Zen approach to doing a lot of things without being caught up in them. And more or less what I wrote some essay somewhere was that even if you have to do a lot of stuff and it's complicated stuff and there's time pressure, all you have to do is just keep track of yourself. Just stay present where you are and pay attention to where you are. And you don't have to get swept away in worry and anticipation. Those are just extra. You don't need that. And that's what Yunyan more or less is saying in the story. I'm not divided, I'm right here. Cutting through all the conceptions of your life and just simply existing in one piece, and then it doesn't matter what's going on, you're always going to be okay. You're not going to be bothered by the pressures of your to-do list. So I think maybe, I think I gave a little retreat on this at Spirit Rock, that's what it was. And somehow, this came to the attention of Oprah Winfrey's then popular television show's people. She had a whole bunch of people, you can imagine. But somehow her people got wind of this, and they asked me, could they reprint whatever it is I wrote for their magazine, the O magazine? And I said, sure. And then sometime later, they invited me to go to Chicago to be on their television show, which I sometimes watched, and I thought I liked it, you know. So I would have gone, but I had to decline because I was too busy with other things. I couldn't go. And they were surprised by this. But later they asked me again. And the second time they asked me, I was also too busy. And this time they said, well, but that's okay. We'll send a film crew to California. And you can appear on the show live, but remotely from California. So I said, well, okay. I guess I can do that. I don't have to go all the way to Chicago. I'll do that. So I did. And I learned two things from this experience. First of all, in case this ever comes up for you, I'm here to tell you that you cannot have any stain on your shirt when you go on television. because a stain that is not necessarily noticeable in person apparently is very noticeable on television. So I remember I had to like pull out shirt after shirt after shirt, and every one of the shirts that I had that was decent had a stain on it. So I had to pick the least objectionable stain. So I'm telling you that in case you ever need to know this. The second thing I learned is that it is really difficult to connect emotionally with people when they are sitting in a television studio in Chicago with a live audience and you are appearing to them as a screen, you know, above them, and they are appearing to you on screen. I couldn't really connect, you know. So I don't think my appearance on the Oprah Winfrey show was much of a success. They never invited me back, but I did interact, you know, and converse with Oprah Winfrey in the show, and she seemed to be a very nice person, sympathetic, patient. The second story dialogue between Yunyan and Dawu has to do with compassion. In Mahayana Buddhism, there's a legend about Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, who listens to the cries of the world, all of them, all of the time. And at one point, he or she or they, because Avalokiteshvara is ambiguously gendered, they found it all too much. So their head exploded, producing an infinite number of heads piled one on top of the other, and an infinite number of hands and arms to go with these heads. And so Buddhist artists began making statues of this multi-headed, multi-armed Avalokiteshvara. I'm sure you've seen these statues. So one day, Yunyan asks Dawu, why does the Bodhisattva of compassion have so many hands and eyes? And Dawu says, it's like reaching back for your pillow in the dark. And Yunyan says, I understand. Dawu says, what do you understand? Yunyan says, the whole body is covered with hands and eyes. Oh, that's really sweet, thank you. That's perfect. So Yunyan says, the whole body is covered with hands and eyes. And Dawu says, that's not bad. That's 80% of it. And Yunyan says, well, what do you say, older brother? And Dawu says, the whole body is nothing but hands and eyes. I'm sure you've heard this story before. It's the locus classicus for the Zen teaching about compassion. All Zen teachers that everywhere are always talking about this story. And more or less, it's just saying that compassion is not something special or even particularly emotional. Compassion is as natural and as reflexive as reaching back half asleep for your pillow in the middle of the night. You do it without even knowing. You're doing it, let alone calling it compassion and thinking that you're a good person because you, you know, reach back for your pillow. And more than this, the story is telling us that compassion is not really a separate and special human phenomenon, a feature of human behavior. It's something more than that. It is, in effect, the reality of the cosmos. That's what Dawu means when he says the whole body is nothing but hands and eyes, that the world appears at all. It's a supreme act of compassion. And so when you know this teaching through and through, when you know how things exist, and you truly appreciate things as they are, you realize that being alive is compassion. And that's the Zen teaching of compassion in a nutshell. And when you appreciate this teaching, it's very natural that you would have a sympathy, a great sympathy in a sense of mutuality with all existing things. not only people, but also animals, and not only animals, but also plants, not only plants, but even inanimate objects are alive. And you want to take care of everything as a matter of course. In a way, this is the teaching behind caring for the altar and the temple in Zen. You know, we take care of the floor and the incense pot with great compassion, realizing that they are alive and that our whole lives depend on them. So Yunyan, who we've been talking about here, was the teacher of another important Zen master, Dongshan. And there are also lots of stories about Dongshan. But the favorite, my favorite one, the one that I'll tell you about today, is the story of him as a boy when he first started practicing. And he asked his teacher, he said, the Heart Sutra says, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. But I have eyes and ears and nose and a tongue and a body and a mind. So what does the sutra mean? And the teacher was so astonished at this astute question that he sent the boy on to study with more profound masters. So Dongshan did go on to study with several eminent Zen teachers, Nanchuan and Guishan, and spent a lot of time with them. But in the end, it was Yunyan who was closest to his heart. And when Yunyan died, Dongshan was doing a memorial service for him. And someone asked him, well, why are you doing the service for Yunyan? Actually, you spent a lot more time with Nanchuan and Guishan, so why do you honor Yunyan especially? And Dongshan said, I honor him because he didn't teach me anything. And the monk said, but since you're conducting a memorial service for Yunyan, you must at least agree with him. And Dongshan said, I half agree. And the monastic said, why don't you completely agree? And Dongshan said, if I completely agreed, I would be ungrateful. So, I have always really appreciated the idea that Zen teachers don't teach you anything. It takes a lot of the pressure off, right, for everybody. I mean, there are so many ways to learn about things, but there are not that many ways to study deeply and not learn anything at all. There's another story, and there are lots, about Zen teachers not teaching anything. This one is about Huangbo. It's a pretty famous story. He once was giving a talk, like I am now, to the assembled monastics, and he said to them, you guys are just gobblers of dregs, traveling around looking for Zen teachers all the time. Why are you wasting your time with the dregs? Don't you know, he said, that there are no teachers of Chan in all of China? And when one of the monastics pointed out to him the obvious fact that China was full of Chan temples and every one of them had a Chan master, including the one that they were in right now, Huangbo replied, I don't say there's no Chan, only no teachers of Chan. Once I was someplace, I don't remember where, and my teacher was there, and I said something like, I maybe was talking about that story, and I said, I appreciated my own teacher very much because he also didn't teach me anything. And he was there at the time. It was pretty true because when I studied with him most closely, maybe the first 10 years, he was very quiet and very modest. He didn't do Dokusan, we almost never talked. But when I said he didn't teach me anything, I think he didn't like that much. I could tell he didn't like it. And years later, I asked him to make some calligraphy on the back of a rakasu, and he gave me a calligraphy that said, I have nothing to give you but my Zen spirit. Which I think was his rejoinder to my saying he didn't teach me anything. But it is true that I did pick up on his Zen spirit of continuous practice. And that's why for some months now I've been thinking about this text of Dogen's called Continuous Practice. And I think the spirit here in Kannada was very much the same. There was a lot of commonality between the way of Kato Roshi and my own teacher now. So Zen teachers don't teach you anything. They are not interested in indoctrinating you into the Buddhist teachings. And they certainly do not want you to idolize them, imitate them, or hold them up as a standard. That's why Dzogchen said that if he fully agreed with his teacher, he would be ungrateful. To express his gratitude fully, he had to digest his teacher's way, half agree, but find his own expression, his own way of uniquely being Dzogchen, which he did. Sometimes people think of Zen stories as being hard to understand for some reason. Either they like to be obscure, and sometimes that seems like a good idea. Or they somehow, maybe what they're saying is so profound that nobody can understand it. Maybe that's true. But mostly, I think, stories are pretty clear. And they make points that we can understand. And, of course, understanding the points is not enough. We have to really take them to heart and transform our lives. But I think the stories are pretty straightforward, like the ones I've been telling you. So in that fascicle of Dogen's that I mentioned, Continuous Practice, he quotes Dzogchen. Dzogchen says, 20 years ago, I wanted to be just one piece, and I have been engaged in Zazen ever since. I also would like to be just one piece, and that's also why I have engaged in Zazen all these years. Before I started Zazen, I didn't feel like I was one piece. I was not at ease in my body or my mind. I remember specifically I had a very ambiguous and tenuous relationship to my left hand. I'm a right-handed person. But especially my left hand and maybe the left side of my body didn't feel right, as if it was attached to me, but so to speak, my heart wasn't in it. Hard to explain this, but possibly some of you know the feeling of not quite completely fitting into your own body. It's equally possible not to fit quite into your own mind, not to feel that your thoughts, your feelings, your impulses don't add up to a proper human life. You're kind of scattered and flailing about, and you're not really sure who you are. And you try to act like a normal human being, and you can do this. But in rare moments of solitude, when the social world drops away, you might feel that the person you are taken to be doesn't really add up. It's an act, and you know it. But when you do Zazen for a while, I don't mean 40 minutes, I mean 10 years, 5 years. Maybe nothing really changes, but you do begin to feel one piece, that you really are here where you are, and this really is your life, that your body, your breathing, your thoughts, your feelings really are here where and as they are. There's no more act, no more strain to be someone you aren't and never were. You get the feeling that the universe had something to say, and it is saying it through the expressive means of your hands and your feet and your shoulders and your thoughts and your words and your deeds. One piece. We're in the continuous practice fascicle to expand on this point about one piece. Dogen next gives further examples of Zen masters who practiced one piece. And he tells a couple of very odd anecdotes about several Zen masters who were really powerful spiritually before they encountered Zen, before they started doing continuous practice. They were really powerful. They were so powerful that heavenly deities used to serve them their meals when they lived in mountain hermitages. We have almost the same thing now. We call it ordering takeout. Somebody comes and brings you. I think it's pretty much the same idea. They had takeout from heavenly deities who came to them and delivered food. However, after they took up continuous practice of being who they were, one place, in one piece, the deities stopped serving them meals because the deities could no longer find them. They were inconspicuous to the deities. So, if you want to have your meals delivered by the deities, don't do continuous practice. So, when you are one piece, when your life is one piece, you really appreciate the simplicity of just living every day, one day at a time. It's a beautiful thing. You're not trying to get anywhere. You're not trying to prove anything. Your life does not require ornamentation, elaboration, or explanation. Dogen mentions Zen Master Zhaozhou, one of his favorites, whose Zen expression was always very plain and everyday, and whose temple was so simple that they didn't even have a storehouse to keep rice. The rice had to be delivered by donors every day. And famously, when the leg of the sitting platform broke, Zhaozhou went and got a piece of charred firewood and strapped it to the platform to hold it up. I've always appreciated this way of taking care of things a lot, much more than my wife does. Anyway, the point is that when you are one piece, you are just wherever you are. You are projecting no person out into the world that the deities might recognize. And you don't need to shore things up, because things will fall apart eventually, and when they do, it's okay to be one piece with that too. Dogen cites the story of Baizhang, who used to do simple manual work every day, and when he was old, insisted on continuing this practice. And it was painful for the monastics to watch him working with his decrepit body, so they confiscated his tools, forcing him to rest. But since he wasn't doing any work anymore, he refused to eat. And he made the famous saying, "A day of no work is a day of no eating," which is a statement describing the simple and concrete life of a one-piece person. In our time, especially around here, so much work that we do is abstract and seemingly not connected to the one-piece world of earth and soil and sky. So it's hard to know, how to make anything out of that attitude. It seems kind of quaint and old-fashioned. And that's true of me too. Mostly my life is a life of abstraction. I spent a lot of time writing and reading and communicating. I think that's typical of most workers around here. And more workers like that are becoming the majority of workers. But I still eat every day. I still wear clothes. I still live in a house. And that means cooking and cleaning up, washing and ironing and mending, cleaning, putting things in order. So I really appreciate these activities and I pay close attention to them. And I try to remember that taking care of my life with attention is a very important part of my One Piece practice, and it's something I do every single day. Continuous practice, One Piece style, is very prosaic, miraculously prosaic, you might say. Zhang Jing studied with Guishan, one of Yunyan's teachers, and said, I lived on Mount Gui for 20 years. I ate Mount Gui's rice and I shat Mount Gui's shit. I wasn't studying the words of Master Guishan. I was just taming a water buffalo, wandering around all day long. I think we all recognize this water buffalo taming as a typical metaphor to describe Zen practice in old China, probably still in China, in the countryside. Maybe, I don't know, I haven't been to China, but maybe they still have water buffaloes that are basic to everyday life. Water buffalo is what you hook your plow up to for farming. Water buffalo dung, which you slapped it against the side of your house so that it would dry for winter fuel. You want to haul anything, you want to go anywhere, you hooked up your water buffalo. So this is really important, water buffalo, to your everyday life. And so you fed and cared for your water buffalo, you doctored them when they were sick, and of course you trained them and tamed them. So continuous practice is taming your water buffalo, your body, mind, your life. And how do you do this? You do it very simply, the way people train the water buffalo, by simply paying attention kindly to your life as it wanders around from here to there, doing this and doing that in the course of a day or an hour or a lifetime. I was just a couple weeks ago in Dublin, Ireland, and I went to the Martello Tower, which is the setting for the opening of James Joyce's novel, Ulysses. And Ulysses, we also went to a pub, and we didn't realize it, but it turned out that it was the pub where on June the 16th, 1904, Joyce first met Nora Barnacle. And it's that day, June the 16th, 1904, that is the day described in Ulysses, a 700-page novel about that one day in the life of Leopold Bloom, the main character of Ulysses. And by the time you get to the end of the novel, it seems like that one day is an eternity, a timeless space that includes many times and places, even though on the calendar, it's just one day. And Ulysses is one of the world's most famous novels, probably because of this, probably because it was one of the first novels to convincingly demonstrate that time and life really are like this. That there's so much going on inside a life on every moment and every day. Much, much more than the mere telling of external events could account for. And this depth and thickness of experience is true for all of us all of the time. so much goes on in our lives, so much that we don't know and see, and so much that we do. The buffalo of the mind and heart and body is going through countless experiences, subtle and minute, all the time. So I'll give you a tip. The easiest way to keep track of your buffalo is to study specifically your suffering. Narrow it down to that. Those moments, sometimes small, sometimes they can be large, when you are annoyed, fatigued, shocked, angry, bored, or otherwise not noticing how wonderful it is to be alive. And if you study your suffering, you will soon recognize that 100% of the time, the reason why you're out of sorts is because what you wished and hoped for, that there would be a parking space, that the yogurt in the store that's always on this shelf would be there and it's not, that somebody not be as crabby and curt and disrespectful of you as they seem to be being. What you had wanted has not been what occurred. That is why you are annoyed. That you wanted someone to live, who's not living. Choose another example that can be very drastic, but it's really the same thing. You didn't want that to be the case, and yet it is. The more you notice that this is always the cause of your suffering, and there's an enormous amount of suffering, small and large, every single day, you recognize that what you're doing is resisting a moment that is there. And that's impossible. You reject this moment of your life as it is. And when you do that, you diminish the luster of your life, making what is inherently superlative and beautiful into something that is dull and unsatisfactory. And when you apply this to yourself, it can be really problematic. When you see this, the more you are inspired to let go of this kind of behavior and just try to accept all of the moments that are here as they're here. Paying attention in this way without hoping for anything special eventually becomes the way you live. Becomes your continuous practice all the time. And when that's true, your life will be one piece. And then, pretty much, there will be no difference between you and these stories and masters of old. No difference at all, really. It will be, you'll just be living just the way that they live. So, I'm done with my talk. Thank you for listening. Why don't we see if there's anything you guys want to say, and that can go for the people online too. I guess there's a way of hearing from them. So if anybody has, it doesn't have to be a question. I'm not a great question answerer. It can be a comment or a reflection. Could be a question. But.
I just wanted to say thanks to you, Norman, for your talk. Just kind of hearing the stories of the great Chinese masters and the words of wisdom that they were always dispensing. And they're so difficult, you know, for us in a different culture and a different time to grasp. And bringing a little bit of light to why they are saying something or what they might really mean, it's very helpful to me. I've kind of read some of these little encounters, and sometimes I kind of get it, but most of the time it just seems like a non sequitur, you know, what the teacher's teaching is. So trying to learn, you know, to look a little bit deeper into those types of interchanges, and you've really made that somewhat more clear for me. I just wanted to say thanks for that.
Anybody else have something to say?
Those stories are all new for me. Thank you. I hadn't heard any of those stories before. Some of the names I had heard of. So I think people who find them new, you're not the only person.
The Zen stories that we know were a literary construction of the Song Dynasty period in China. And so they were taking sometimes oral and sometimes written stories from earlier Zen teachers and kind of shaping them and crafting them into a literature, the like of which didn't exist before in China or in Buddhism in India either. And to some extent, you know, Zen in China was a reaction to the kind of confusing complexity of Buddhism that was coming into China from India over a period of many hundred years, piecemeal. So there were all these different philosophical schools, quite different from one another. And if you were in India, you could see how they developed, you know, one after another in an organic way. But if you were in China and you got a piece of this and a piece of that and a piece of this, it was very confusing. What is this Buddhism? And it was complicated and quite scholastic. And it sort of didn't quite sit well with the Chinese culture, which was formed by Taoism and Confucianism, and had a language and a way of expression that was quite different from the Indian language. It's possible that the difference between China and India at that time was greater than the difference between China and the United States now. I mean, it was really vastly different culturally. So that's why it was sort of an inevitable thing that the Chinese were going to rewrite Buddhism. And the style was very different. And that's what they came up with, was these stories. And the idea was, well, in a little story like this, you can encapsulate six volumes of theory about reality. And it could just appear as a short little story about two guys sweeping the ground. I mean, there's a whole thing in there about what is it, what are the two moons, and it comes from a very involved a sutra in which somebody puts their hand on their eyeball, right? You can do this. And they look up in the sky and there's two moons. Have you ever done that? Yeah, there's two moons. If you put your hand on your eyeball and press a little bit and look up, you'll see two moons. Which is the real moon? Is one real and the other one not? And as you can imagine, this is a whole philosophy of perception and consciousness and mind and all of this. Well, forget about that. Are there two moons? Which moon is this? That's it, you know. So it's most of the Zen stories really are a challenge for us to see if we can answer the story with our life. Not just understand it, but can our life be the answer to that story? Can we be just sweeping, just here in our lives? Then the question of perception and consciousness is moot. We're living it. So that's sort of the thrust of the Zen literature. But it, you know, it's something that we are getting used to here in the Western culture, where we don't have that. We didn't go through all that cultural transformation of the teachings, so we're trying to understand these Zen teachings ourselves. And every time someone gives a Dharma talk, it's another attempt to understand these teachings in a way that we can understand them, because we do want to understand them and we do want to make them real in our living. Somebody else I know has something to say.
I was thinking as you were talking, Norman, about when you said to investigate your own suffering, the little and small, the little and big moments, and I was wondering if that could be thought of as cultivation. And if you could talk a little bit more about that, what it would be like to, you know, cultivate your suffering, I guess.
Yes, well, cultivation, I forget the word in Sanskrit, is a Buddhist word, actually, for practicing. Practice is like cultivating, and it's the same idea as cultivating the fields, right? You grow crops. If you plant crops, you need to cultivate soil before you plant and after you plant. And it's a painstaking daily effort. So, yes, the craft of our practice, the cultivation and the craft of cultivation of practice is our paying attention every day and learning how to live every day, learning how to understand our own mind, because everybody's mind is a little different, right? We're all human, so in that sense, we all have the same mind. But the way that human mind appears depends on our conditioning, and we all have different conditioning, so our conditioning is not irrelevant. On the other hand, we have to understand what we're trying to do and not let our conditioning rule us and get the best of us, you know. So we have to cooperate with it because we are as we are because of our conditioning. On the other hand, we have to be liberated within our conditioning. So that's the path of cultivation, moment by moment, paying attention to your life and understanding your responses and just being curious about what it is to be you and what it is to practice these teachings. So I think that it can't be a kind of blunt instrument, you know, where you have a set of concepts and rules and you apply them, you know, in some crude way. It's more subtle, understanding more subtly what's going on here, what am I doing, how am I acting, what's my mind and heart, and what's my body doing. I think if you study the Mindfulness Sutra, it's mostly about being aware of the body. And in Zazen, we're really focusing on the body. Breathing and the posture and the sensations in the body is mostly what we're doing in Zazen. So paying attention to the body is a huge part of it. And you know this very often. Another thing, I didn't say this in my talk, but when you're suffering, you immediately notice, oh, I've lost track of my body. I'm not in my body anymore. My body is twisted up in some way or behind this suffering. So yes, it's all of that, all of that. When you are cleaning the toilet, how are you cleaning the toilet? There's different ways of doing it. You know? And how present are you? And if you're not present, where are you? And what are you thinking about? Oh, that's interesting. I'm cleaning the toilet and I'm thinking about this. Whoa, I wouldn't have noticed if I didn't try to pay attention. So all the time, paying attention. And the how of doing physical things is always very subtle, you know. There's different ways of doing it. I think that I always try to do things in the most elegant and simple way possible, because you can do things in a way that makes twice as much work for you, right? You can, like, clean your house, and it can be a very hard job if you make more work for yourself. So you think, oh, well, the details I can't think of, but yes, where do you keep things, and how do you organize your desk? It's all of that. That's all part of the cultivation of practice. And it makes living, you know, very interesting. Very interesting. So, yeah, cultivation is a good word for practice. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah, this is May, and I'm on the roll. And when you talk about this nothing and then teach nothing, I just remember when I'm from China, and then when we came to the United States, I think that our favorite show is Seinfeld, you know, a show about nothing. And then I think Seinfeld is a very great Zen master. So I just want to hear some comments from you about Seinfeld.
If the mic is where it is now, can all of you hear me online? Put your thumb up if you can hear me. Okay, you can. I'm a big fan of Seinfeld too, and Jerry Seinfeld. Although I like his other show, Comedians in Cars Having Coffee, better than I like Seinfeld. I think that I've given Dharma talks on Comedians in Cars Having Coffee. I would say better off going to a Zen center than depending on Seinfeld show to figure your life out. That's what I think. Yeah. I'm not a disciple of Seinfeld. So Dawa, what did you want to say?
Also thinking back to a recent talk of yours with Everyday Zen, and I think in that talk you were talking about a talk you had given, and I think in that talk you were saying that with practice we have stability, confidence, and hope. Or those are three things. And then I was thinking about this question about cultivation and continuous practice. And so it seems like when we're sitting Zazen, that is a cultivation of stability. I can see how that directly feels like stability of the body and, you know, sitting still with whatever's coming up and so on. I just was wondering about whether continuous practice, then we naturally have the confidence and hope, or if those are also things that we sometimes choose to cultivate more directly.
And I guess I would say it's both. I do think that fundamentally the practice is just paying attention and, you know, applying your intelligence and your understanding as it grows over time to the minutia of your daily life, and I think everything comes from that. But at the same time, if you want to, you can also cultivate something intentionally and do various, there's a million ways you can practice, and the Buddhism in Zen and outside of Zen has many, many ways that you can cultivate. But in that talk, I was more or less saying that confidence and hopefulness will come as you practice. For instance, when you study your suffering, when you pay attention to your life, you begin to see very clearly how, when you have what they call technically in Buddhism afflictive emotions, afflictive thoughts and emotions, you see how that leads to suffering and trouble. All the time, only. That's where it goes. So, I hate her. You see where that thought takes you. It doesn't take you anyplace good, you know, it doesn't give you any good way to live. So you realize, okay, I may have that thought, and I maybe I can't help it, but at least I understand that I don't want to cultivate that thought. I don't want to encourage that thought because it's not helping. First of all, it's giving me a really bad attitude toward her, and I have to see her, and it's making me miserable, and I'm obsessed with it, blah, blah, you know. So I've got to, that's not, you really see that. So that's where the confidence comes from. The confidence comes from an absolute conviction that you will develop over time of practice that to do, think, and speak on the good side is good, always. Do, think, and speak on the bad side is always bad. And you want to not do that as much as possible. And that gives you the confidence to know, I know what to do and what not to do. And so no matter what's going on, no matter how bad the situation is, and you know that the world is full of very bad situations that we have been unsuccessful in preventing, big world, we're not in charge of it. When bad things happen, I know what to do. I have confidence. I'm not freaked out that something bad is happening and I'm now powerless. No, I am powerful enough to know how to choose the good and do good, because all I have to do is in my own mind, you know, starting there. So we have confidence when we practice this way. And hopefulness, I think, is a more subtle point, but it also comes from our work on the cushion and our lives as we observe them off the cushion. Because you realize that being alive in the present moment is much more profound and various than you thought. You find that on the cushion. You realize, like, you know, we all have experienced that 40 minutes is not always 40 minutes, right? Sometimes 40 minutes is several hours. Sometimes 40 minutes is 10 minutes. You know, 5 minutes in the dentist chair is not the same 5 minutes as 5 minutes looking at the sunset. 5 minutes is not a piece of time. 5 minutes is an experience. A moment comes and goes. Life is every moment coming and going. So, every moment has the whole past in it, right? This moment of your life wouldn't be as it is if everything that happened before in everywhere were not as it did. That's how come this moment. So there's no present moment. There's only the whole of the past. And in this present moment, the potential for the future is here, in this moment. And potential is a very funny word, right? Potential means the reality of something that doesn't yet exist. And yet, you can see that thing. So a great example is a child. Why would we like children, you know? Children are so funny looking. They're so little, their heads are bigger than they should be, and so on. They're not really that good looking, and yet to us, children are really beautiful, right? Why are they beautiful? Because you can see in the child. You can see it. It's there. It's actually there in the child, the potential for an unfolding life. And the potential is so beautiful that we love children. And the children actually look good to us, and it's the potential that we're seeing, right? So in other words, potential is an actual thing, paradoxically, even though it doesn't exist. Similarly, the future is in the present, even though the future doesn't yet exist. And the future is unknown. No one knows what's going to happen in the next moment. No one knows. You could have the biggest computer anywhere in the whole universe, and it would not be able to predict what's going to happen in the next moment, because in order for to predict what happens in the next moment, it assumes that everything that happened before will continue to happen as it was, and then we can predict. But it never does continue as it was. It cannot. Future is always unknown. Therefore, it's always hopeful. Something bad could happen in the future, definitely. But then there'll be another moment, and then you don't know what, good or bad. So when you really understand your life and time, you understand that being alive is an inherently hopeful situation. It's inherently hopeful to be alive, and you understand that. So that gives you a lot of resilience when bad things happen. You know, that does not kill hope. Bad things don't kill hope. They're dark times. You know, we have this election coming, and depending on your point of view, one way or the other, somebody's going to be deeply disappointed, and somebody's going to feel like the whole world has gone dark because of what happened in this election. Half the country's going to feel that way, no matter what. But if you really have continuous practice, you will say, okay, here's the situation now. Hope is not destroyed. My confidence is strong. Let's figure out what we're supposed to do now under these conditions. And when you have that spirit, you always find out something that can be done. So, and I was giving that little speech. It was, I originally, I really originally thought of those ideas when I was sitting up on the stage in the benefit in Santa Rosa that I gave for the Zen Center there. And then I thought, oh, that's a good idea, and I wrote it down, and then I gave it on the top line. Because I think those are good points to remember for these times, that our practice does give us strength. It gives us stability and confidence and hopefulness, and that's what we need in tough times. And yes, we can cultivate them, and I think the main way to cultivate them would be by observing the opposite that arises within us. So when we feel a lack of hope, and when we feel no confidence, to notice that we feel that way, and then you actually do have to talk to yourself. You know, you have to say to yourself, okay, I feel this way, and it's very convincing, but I've thought about this, it's not true. And you have to just sort of like take yourself in hand and say, let me not go down that path of obsessing over this thought. It would be so easy to do. Let me not do that. I know better. So then you might have to do like, okay, I'm stopping what I'm doing here, and I'm going to go out and look at the sky for 5 minutes just to get myself out of that rut or whatever. You learn how to do things. You learn what you know what you need. We're all taking care of ourselves just the same way we take care of our baby, you know. We're our own baby. So, oh, she's hungry. better give her a cookie, you know, whatever. This is what she needs now. I know what she needs. But she's not doing well. She needs something. And we take care of ourselves. We might be out of time. What would be out of time? Are we out of time?
11:20.
It is 11:20 now?
Yes.
And what time are we supposed to end? We don't know. We don't know. Okay. Well, I think it feels like we're just about done, but anybody else, online or otherwise, want to say something? Yeah.
Yeah, I appreciated Dongchan's question.
Yeah.
It when seems.
He was a boy,
yeah, when he was a boy. It seems like such an innocent
question.
And. I mean, I don't think it ever occurred to me when I was, you know, chanting the Heart Sutra regularly. It just never occurred. And I'm wondering your thoughts on his question or yeah.
Well, I don't know. I mean. I guess when you think about it, if you chant the Heart Sutra all the time and you never think to ask that question, I guess it means that either you're ignoring the Heart Sutra and just thinking it's just a bunch of words, I have no idea, it doesn't matter, or you have some vague idea of what it means, and it's probably some conceptual thought that doesn't really matter that much to you. You just sort of, either way, you know, you're not. I think what's great about Dongshan's question as a young boy is that he really takes the Heart Sutra seriously. And he says, it really does mean there are no eyes and no ears. So what's going on here? You know, I have eyes and ears. So he takes it very seriously with a lot of faith. And it troubles him. And I think it should trouble us to know that we are living in a world that, according to the Heart Sutra, if we have faith in it, is not the real world. The Heart Sutra is telling us, you are living in a world that's not the real world. See the real world and live in the real world. And that's the world of one piece. That's the world of continuous practice. So my eye, When of course, you know, there's a Thich Nhat Hanh I can't remember where or when, but toward the end of his life, he actually, and God bless Thich Nhat Hanh, only he could do this, you know. He said, for however many thousand years, they've been misunderstanding the Heart Sutra and translating it improperly. And he went and did a whole bunch of scholarship. Oh, there's me. You were just on the computer. How'd that happen? He says they've been mistranslating it, and you know, it has to do with the expression "no eyes, no ears," because the Heart Sutra is really—it's an extreme way of putting it, but the Heart Sutra is not nihilistically denying the existence of eyes and ears. This world you live in does not exist. That's a nihilistic thought, and the Heart Sutra is explicitly saying we're not talking about nihilism. So really, the Heart Sutra is not saying no eyes, no ears. It's saying the eyes and the ears as you understand them are not the eyes and the ears of reality. They're not. This perceptual world that you live in and take to be a hard and fast and threatening world is not the world that it seems to be. So I think the young boy feels this. And in a certain way, you know, at some point in your life, the thought that what you have always taken to be the case is not the case can be a very upsetting thought at some point, right? I mean, I think that the beauty of continuous practice is that you kind of get used to that over time, and so it's not a threatening thought. But when you first hear about it, I mean, to have an enlightened experience of seeing that the world is not as you took it to be when you're not ready for it can be very destabilizing. It can make you literally crazy, right? So I think something like that is what the Dongshan is feeling. I mean, he's crazy, but I think he's really upset at the truth of this and needing to know, how do I live with that truth? And how do I practice and take it into account? And that's why the teacher sends him on to study further. Yeah. Does that speak to what you're...
Yeah.
Yeah.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.